kind of out of it. My chair feels like really out of whack. I think my desk is too high, and my chair armrest might be too high or too low right now. I can't tell.
Are you okay?
I'm fine. I'm tired. Been editing all day as fast as I possibly can. You ever do, like, you have some tasks, and you're like, they're not really that complicated tasks, but you have so many of them that you just, like, you spend all day doing them as fast as you possibly can, and then at the end of it, you're just like, ugh, you just want to fall down and lay on the floor?
Yes, I would say so, but what are the tasks that you are doing? I mean, you're editing, is this the stuff you shot a couple weeks ago?
Kind of, sort of. I didn't shoot it. I was there. So basically, I'm editing. Basically, I'm editing slides to a keynote presentation and timing them, and then like fading them in and fading them out or whatever. But like, you know, if you give a keynote, here's a pro tip for people who give presentations: if you give a keynote presentation and you have 190 slides, you're probably a bad presenter. Like, don't do that. I mean, no, it was a good presentation, don't get me wrong, but like you're a bad person for making the people like me. Also, if you're going as fast as you possibly can, maybe one time you'll mark in and mark out and like accidentally clear the mark in, and then when you hit overwrite, you'll overwrite everything that came before that, but you won't notice it until you're like way down at the end there on like slide 180 that you erased everything from slide 100 to 150, and then like since Premiere only undoes 32 events, that you had to like basically redo that part. Hypothetically speaking, that was fun.
Save early and save often.
I save every 5 seconds though, and that's not the problem. Like it's saved.
No. When I say save, I don't mean just save over the existing version of your file.
Oh, you mean iterate and save?
Yes.
I would have 5,000 versions because every time I drop in a new edit, I hit save. It's just like a compulsion. Mark in, mark out, overwrite, clear, mark in again, hit save, and then go to the next slide.
But how does that help you if you're saving that and it's a status that you don't want?
Well, it helps me because if Premiere decides it feels like crashing,
it has auto recovery now.
Well, it does have auto recovery, and it did auto recover after one point when it crashed. But then one of my multicam clips is just like, "Yeah, we only have one of the cameras." I'm like, "No, it's literally right there. Like both clips are still in the bin." But the multi clip thing that had both, that's supposed to have both clips in it, it's like, "Yeah, this camera doesn't exist." I'm like, "No, it's there. You could just like use the clip the way it's supposed to be instead of just black." And I restarted the application and it was still gone. And I had to restart my entire computer for some reason. Mm. So Premiere would just like, "Oh yeah, that clip, we found that media. It's right here." I'm like, "Duh, it's right there in the bin because it was there the whole time."
The whole time.
So that's what saving often prevents, mm-hmm, theoretically. Anyway, I've been putting Premiere through its paces. It's actually been pretty solid. It's actually surprisingly quick. My fingers are still faster than the program, which is kind of a bummer.
This is on your fancy iMac, right?
It was on my fancy iMac, yeah.
Well, that's nice. I'm sure that has nothing to do with the performance boost that you're seeing over your previous computer.
No, it's been pretty solid. It's been good. I don't like Premiere. The buttons are weird and the tools are weird, but I've bent it to my will, at least on this project.
Yeah, I was using it this morning, as a matter of fact, for a...
Were you making an animoji?
I could have been. Still am. It's not done yet. But at some point...
Are you really? Did I just get the exclusive scoop on you making an animoji karaoke?
Yes, yes.
Or are you doing a scene from a movie? You're doing a scene from a movie, aren't you?
It might be a scene from a movie, but...
yeah. So, is it a Star Trek? Is it a Wrath of God?
I mean, all of those things you said could be actually 100% accurate, but I can neither confirm nor deny them. What I can tell you is I'm not in charge of digitally replacing an actor in a movie that's going to be premiering December 22nd.
My God, I didn't know if you wanted to talk about that or not, but oh my God.
I feel like we have to talk about that because I just can't... I couldn't process it when I saw that news had happened. I was like... Is this serious?
And there's no way they can keep that release date, right?
No, I mean, well, there is. It depends. It really depends because if your reshoots mainly consist of Christopher Plummer in a shot by himself talking to someone off screen and then cutting to your other actors and you crop in on whatever that footage is for their reaction shots, then sure, you saved a lot of time and money with that. If there are a lot of shots where, let's say, a previous actor who is in the news is being replaced, if he's interacting with the other characters, the other actors on set, and for whatever reason you can't get them back or the sets or whatever, then you could be doing some more complicated digital replacements. One thing I did like, though, in the THR, the Hollywood Reporter report about this, which I didn't read when I had initially read they were doing this. I drove home and then I saw this a little later. But apparently, this was Ridley Scott's idea, and also the writer for THR figured out that MPC would be doing some or most or all, and decided that because of their work on Blade Runner 2049, it could be like that, but on a shorter time frame. And I was thinking to myself, no, it's not like that. They're not making a digital recreation of Christopher Plummer and then putting him into these scenes. That's not how that's functioning at all. They are taking a photographic version of Christopher Plummer shot somewhere and putting him into this footage and erasing the previous actor. And that's not remotely the same as recreating someone from many years ago or someone who's dead. It's a different situation. The actor who's being replaced is being replaced for some stuff that came to light in the news and seems to be unfolding still, so we won't go into too much detail, but Kevin Spacey did bad things, and they're out there to read about. Just Google Kevin Spacey and you will find it. And we kind of mentioned it last week when we were talking about Nine Lives for a second, but he's not great, and he's being removed from the movie. Ridley Scott unilaterally decided to do this, according to the THR story. I didn't read that initially when I had saw the news, and I was just in shock that he would unilaterally decide to do this.
I feel like that's a retcon for the story, because I'm sure he ran it past the studio, and the studio said, like, look, if you think you can do this, like, we're going to put your name on this decision for insurance purposes, but, like, If this is a big Christmas movie for them and they're like actually hoping to make some money, like, they're totally on board with this idea if he can pull it off.
No.
And not just like shove the delivery 3 months down the line.
This is not a moneymaker movie. This is an please give me an Oscar movie.
Well, still.
Yeah, no, but there is a difference. And I feel like that's the reason why Kevin Spacey is being replaced, because it's not just that it's commercially unpalatable to have a movie with him in it right now in this current climate, but it would be disastrous for awards. And if you're making a movie that is just about getting awards, then you don't want to have someone in there who will be poison. I don't know how the Academy will receive the movie now. I shouldn't say now, because they haven't done anything yet. I don't know how they'll receive the movie once the work is done. Because they could still be freaked out by the whole entire thing and dislike it for those reasons and it not win any awards. But it's just a total crapshoot. I mean, nothing like this has really ever happened before, to my knowledge. Actors have been replaced several times during production, where it's like, yeah, you're not working out, whatever. Star Trek Voyager, Kate Mulgrew wasn't the first actress who was going to play Janeway for 7 years. Although, after watching 7 years of her on the show, it's like, who else would have played her? And then you go back and you watch the first actress who was cast in that role, and you're just like, wow, she was bad. Like, they actually
shot
footage with her.
Definitely the first example that comes to my mind, and definitely not Back to the Future.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's also that.
There's also Back to the Future.
What was it, Eric Stoltz?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was. Michael J. Fox replaced him.
They shot with him for what, like 2 weeks, or was it 2 months? I can't remember. They shot with him for a while, at least.
Something with the two. But you can replace somebody when you're in production, swap them out, redo those scenes, continue with the rest of the film. When you finish the film and you're getting ready to distribute it in basically a month and a half, 2 months, then you don't really have the leeway to reshoot and replace, except, of course, in a world where you can do many of those things digitally, not by recreating those performances, but by just slicing and dicing digitally, which is what they're going to have to do in a very compressed time
span.
Clever
wipes, basically, right?
Yeah. Well, Like I said, there's some of this that you could do just by re-editing your footage so that you have a shot of Christopher Plummer and then a shot of whatever it was with, you know, the previous actor cropped out as a reaction shot and go
and
back and forth.
You're going to have lighting concerns and that sort of stuff. So I did, one thing I wanted to ask you from color timing perspective, how would you go about reshooting this if you were in charge of this? Would you literally fly from location to location and try and like recreate the setups with lighting, or would you go for, I don't know, would you go for like a green screen and try to get like a light stage setup if they had HDRs of each lighting setup and try and like do LED panels to sort of reproject the lighting from the actual other footage onto him, or like what would you do?
Well, in the case of this movie, according to the stories, apparently Spacey had only been involved in 8 days of shooting, so he was not in as much of this movie as you might expect.
I would have expected a lot more based on, because I'd never heard of it. I looked at it and reading the plot, it sounds like he's one of the main characters, so that I find that hard to believe, but okay.
Well, it's about the abduction of Getty's son, the oil slash art magnate guy. His son gets abducted, and it's not about him as a central character. Think Big Lebowski. It's not about the guy whose rug gets stolen. So I think that's sort of the same sort of thing you're dealing with here. 8 days of shooting is still a lot of shooting. Like, that's nothing. It's not like it was just a small cameo beforehand.
Especially considering you have, 35 days until it's supposed to come out or something? Well, I guess it's a little longer than that. It's like 45, 50 days.
Yeah. Because we're just at the start of November, and it's going to be just before the end of December. So it's not that long. And to have this story come out today because you got Christopher Plummer on board today and you haven't actually done anything yet is a little surprising. Having said that, there are shorter turnarounds on episodic TV visual effects shots, for split screens and stuff like that. So it's possible to do these things. It's just, you know, it just depends on what these shots originally were. We don't have any access to what they did. Like, if it was like, oh yeah, we want to have a long walk and talk on the beach, and then it needs to blend in with these 35 other shots, then that's a totally different can of worms than
it's Ridley Scott. I think it's a fair bet that there's going to be a lot of locked off camera that's like kind of panning and tilting around a little bit. But yeah, there's got to be some mix in of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, if he's in a relatively contained environment, it is conceivable that you could replace him and it not be that big of a deal. The only real issue is how he would be layered into that scene. Like, if he's like shaking hands with every fifth person, then you need to have those people there for that interaction. If he's just sitting in a chair or something, or he walks from one side of the room to the other, then no big deal. It's still work to do, but it's not impossible or something that would require sort of advanced techniques in order to achieve the kind of interaction with the previous footage that you needed.
But even on like a basic level, it's like step one, paint out existing actor. Step two, find a way to shoot new actor, presumably against green screen, but also with the lighting, that environment that would have been around him at the time, and then combine after that. So like, at a very minimum, you know, there's a couple of steps here that have to go right in order for this to even like sell in the slightest.
Yeah, well, if he's on, if they have access to the sets that they used or the props, like if he's sitting in a chair, like I said, and they still have that chair, they can shoot him sitting in that chair, and then they don't have to worry about weird hair edges or something like that. If they have him walking outdoors, then you get into more complicated, tricky things where you might need to green screen him. In any way you want to talk about it, it's still a lot of work for the amount of time that they have to do it. And I don't envy the people who are going to be going into this working period on this specific part of the project, because something tells me nobody really anticipated having this work to do. So best of luck.
Oh, good Lord. Apparently this is going to be a weekly segment on the show called Real Time Feedback with Todd Mazzieri. He just sent a joke tweet response back saying almost done with shot one, where he's crudely photoshopped a face over top of him.
Oh dear. Oh dear.
It's very bad looking.
Oh, Todd.
He's going to be horrified again once he notices that we're live.
He'll figure it out.
He logged back into the chat room last week just long enough to say that he was horrified and then leave again. I'm sure he'll do that again here shortly.
Yes. So, listeners who are not aware of who Todd is, and you should be, Todd Mazzieri. Go follow him on the internet. He complains.
He's good. He's good, Todd. He's a friendly Todd.
Yeah, as Todds go, he's not bad.
He's your friendly neighborhood Todd.
Could be worse. Could be Todd McFarland. This is a good one.
That's the Spawn guy.
Yeah,
yeah. He used to live down the street from my cousin.
Oh,
I'm pretty sure he still lives here in Phoenix, right?
I have no idea.
Yeah,
he seems like a Phoenix person.
He lived in the fancy neighborhoods over by the Frank Lloyd Wrights's in the equestrian area, not too far from here.
Huh.
I don't know. I don't think he had horses. I think he just liked to live horse adjacent.
Hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the more you know. But anyway, Todd worked for ILM and does digital people things sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's good to hear from Todd. And it's really horrendous, the work that he did on his little joke.
See, this is what they need to avoid when they do the real thing. The lighting and the face and the perspective, it's not right. It's not good. Doesn't the skin.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't try to do just a facial replacement, would they? They wouldn't try to do something.
No.
I mean, just like roto a head off and then comp the new head on. Because I've done that before, but that doesn't work very well.
They're not going to be that sloppy. They are going to remove the original actor completely. Yeah, I can bet you that the first thing they're going to do is start paint work immediately on removing the
right,
original actor.
They can do that while they're figuring out the logistics for shooting somewhere, right?
Yes, exactly. And then they can also use these for informing how they're going to be doing their shot setups for things. Because I don't know what they originally shot this on. I assume it was digital. I assume they have some room to scale it up, but they might be repoing a lot of these shots in order to cover parts of the frame that would be more of an issue than other parts of the frame.
I already forgot. What was this movie called?
All the Money in the World?
All the Money in the World. I'm going to do some research.
Was that the name of it? I feel like that is. Yes.
That's the name of it. Something about money's in the world.
Yeah. Coincidentally, the bill for the work that they're going to be doing.
Well, it's there are no technical specs other than that they anticipate that it's going to be printed to a DCP. Like, well, no crap.
Oh, my God. They're going to print a DCP? No way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that IMDb's category, like the little cell, like you got color aspect ratio and they've got printed film format, DCP. They might want to change that to, like, I don't know, distribution format or something.
So, anywho, that's that topic, that mini topic, the news.
But like a lot of these photos, these are like exterior desert scenes. Like, I wouldn't want to try and shoot that on a green screen set and just recreate that lighting. But at the same time, I also want to like fly out to the middle of some godforsaken desert just to get like a pickup shot of Christopher Plummer against a green screen.
Yep. Well,
I mean, there's lots of deserts in Eastern California. They could probably find one similar enough and then sort of like coordinate where the sun's supposed to be.
I mean, probably not. Something tells me those exterior shots there will be just green screen.
Hmm.
Anyway, better than the alternative of not releasing your film or...
But like if ever there was a reason to push a release by a month or two, like... Oh. Seems pretty reasonable here.
No, but see, Dan, this is the thing. Remember when I was talking about this being Oscar bait?
Yes.
It has to release by the end of the year.
When's the cutoff for the Oscars? Is it?
It's the end of the year.
Oh.
It can go into wide release after the end of the year, but it needs to be this calendar year.
Well, then at least push it to the 31st or something and give yourself a couple of days. I don't know, man. I mean,
yeah.
There's just going to be like sweaty, dirty VFX people sleeping on floors. Like, give them an extra week to do the stuff.
Yeah, no, Dan, I don't envy the people who are going to be involved in this. But
makes me wonder, like, I've had a recent uptick in inquiries for visual effects schedules or availability, and now I kind of just want to like turn off email and run away for a little while.
Something tells me that that uptick had nothing to do with this particular situation.
Probably true, but at the same time, yeah. Like, why risk it?
You don't want to be accidentally invited to work on this.
Better safe than sorry, because most of the time there's like, you know, you got a code name, you got an NDA, and then all of a sudden you see plates showing up, and you're like, oh god, it's this movie.
Yeah. No. Yeah,
but in all seriousness, this is not a good mm-mm. thing for anybody involved. It's going to be a lot of work for filmmakers, and it's all for a bad reason, too.
Yeah, and on top of that, all the work that the people are going to be putting into this, all the blood, sweat, and tears, will be for what should be an invisible effect.
Right. And it's not going to be a kind of thing where people are going to want to be like, put it on my demo reel, be like, look what I did. I erased that really bad guy out of a movie because we had to do that.
Yeah, no. Not even that, but just the fact that you're painting out someone and putting in a different actor, nobody's going to care. And the audience won't be impressed because most people are not going to know the full story of this. I think it's going to make big waves in the people who care about like film things, the cinephile community and all of the VFX artist communities and all this stuff. Like it'll be a big deal, but like, as far as like, our mothers or other people, like, they're not going to care or know about any of this. And they'll be like, oh, look, did you see that new Christopher Plummer movie? And it'll be like, no, I didn't.
Well, you know, there's potential for a wide public narrative about how difficult it was, because everyone's very interested in how difficult The Revenant was. And this might potentially be more difficult to make than The Revenant.
No, that's just a lobbying campaign for the Oscars, not so much a public campaign.
So do you think maybe they'll lobby for like a best visual effects thing for this movie because of all the work they had to do on such a short timeline?
Well, I mean, Ridley stooped to taking a comedy Oscar for his work for The Martian. So
he stooped, like he made the conscious decision to receive an Oscar.
That was not a funny movie.
No, it was.
And the studio lobbied for an Oscar for comedy for that. So
yeah, but yeah. It won. So,
I know. Clearly, that's what lobbying's for.
Yeah, but like lobbying gets
for
you
your
foot
consideration.
In the door.
FYC. Yeah.
Isn't FYC the place in the mall where you could like order CDs in the mail or something?
No, that's FYE.
Oh, there you go.
I think they went out of business. But no, FYC is when you come to Los Angeles and every bus stop, billboard, and the sign that you see says FYC and then some project. Because it's all about lobbying for the people who can vote on these projects to vote on those projects so that they can win things. And sometimes they're clever, and sometimes they just say FYC, and sometimes they're just everywhere because they have a lot of money to spend. So that's what you got to deal with when it comes to lobbying.
Yeah. Back when I used to read paper versions of Variety, I used to see that all the time.
I'm sorry. you had a subscription for paper versions of Variety to arrive in the mail?
It was a very long time. I think I got one, like I don't know, like the back of a box of cereal or something you can mail away for like a free 6 months of Variety or something. I don't remember how I got it. It wasn't daily Variety. I think it was, I don't even know if it was weekly Variety. It might have been monthly.
How old were you that, wait, what cereal?
No, I don't remember.
Was
where
it
I
Grape
got
Nuts?
It.
Like, what? No. What could they possibly
I don't know how. I didn't pay for it. That's all I know. I got like 6 months of it or something. And I was in my early 20s.
Okay.
I was interested in the trades, as they say.
Ugh.
I remember reading them on the various Intel airplanes as I traveled back and forth from all those places to do our terrible video work.
Okay. Well, We've spent enough time on that. Let's move on to our movie.
Sure.
Yeah, a movie where no actor was digitally replaced. Rod puppets were digitally replaced, but yeah, that's about it.
There's a lot of CG in this movie.
A lot, and you can tell whenever it is CG.
July 2nd, 1997. Where were you when this movie came out?
I think I saw it opening weekend.
Oh, I did too. I went and saw it for my birthday because my birthday's on the 5th.
Yeah, I mean,
it was a big deal.
I was 12, so I liked it. It was a good movie. I didn't really have sophisticated thoughts and opinions about it being a good movie, but I just thought it was really neat and unlike anything else I had seen prior to this. And I had seen Barry Sonnenfeld's other work, that being Adam's Family and Adam's Family Values, which were stinkers, and I didn't really care for those. But this somehow turned out to be a very interesting and eye-opening movie in how you could sort of have all of these things going on and see them work in a way that they didn't just all break or become weird or feel out of place inside of the narrative structure of the film. Like, everything here...
There's a lot of weird stuff in here, though, isn't there? There's a lot of different tones. You got your comedy, you got your up-and-coming young character and the old guys and the sadness of love and retiring, and then you've got, like, brutal murder in here somewhere, and then aliens and all kinds of funny stuff.
No, but it's a good weird.
Oh, yeah, I agree. Yeah, it all works. It's just, like, in retrospect, like, trying to analyze the pieces of this movie, I think there's one piece that I'm sure we'll get to later that feels weird to me. But on the whole, like, it manages to, like, you know, put its own tone and spin on everything, so it feels like it exists within this its own little universe of the movies, like long before a cinematic universe was kind of a thing that people were thinking about. It does have very much its own kind of world that it like pushes everything into, so it makes it easier to swallow some of these horrible things that you're looking at.
Swallow is a good word. This movie starts with a dragonfly, a CG dragonfly, flying through title cards that look very similar to the title cards for Adam's Family movies. Then the dragonfly splats on a truck. And the whole entire time it's going on, there is this very bombastic, propulsive score by Danny Elfman blowing up your eardrums.
Very Danny Elfman.
Very Danny Elfman. And this is good Danny Elfman, I must say. There is good Danny Elfman, and then there is less than good Danny Elfman.
What is less than good Danny Elfman?
I would say some of the later, more recent stuff that he's done has not been that amazing. Particularly when you get into things like Age of Ultron, that sounded like nothing. That sounded like just a big pile of nothing.
There was music in Age of Ultron?
There was. It was just very generic and boring, and you didn't really want to listen to it. And he's done some other things. But this was back when he would do very interesting, quirky, avant-garde stuff. So you're thinking of the era of Batman, and you're thinking of the era of Mars Attacks, which is a terrible movie, just awful. But
like even Edward Scissorhands era is still kind of like the same in the same wheelhouse as this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and Beetlejuice, and eventually after this, he would go on to do Planet of the Apes, which would sort of define his style for the 2000 to 2008-ish period.
The Mark Wahlberg, Tim Roth one.
Yeah. Oh God, it's bad. Tim Burton. Yeah, so
you drag a carpet behind a car and then you run on the carpet and they look like they're going real fast.
It doesn't look like that, but they were very happy with that. So you get the big title card sequence and the music and stuff and the splat, and there is a truck driven by a guy, and in the back there are a bunch of people. And it very quickly becomes obvious that these are people who are being smuggled across the border. They are caught by law enforcement. who take them all outside of the car. And then Tommy Lee Jones shows up, he has an old fellow with him as well, also in a suit. And as we know from the title of the film, Men in Black, that these people who are in black suits are probably, you know, central to the plot of this film. And Tommy Lee Jones gives an excuse about why he needs to be able to talk to these people and stuff like that. And he goes through the line of people, addressing them all in Spanish. And then he gets to the last guy who doesn't speak any Spanish. And you start to slowly unravel that something is off. And he has these other people go back to the car, and then he has the guy walk with them over there, and then they take off his parka thing that he has on, and he's an alien who's holding his head on a stick. Yeah.
Yeah, and then he's got a lot of gills and eyes that flip back over his head, and they're talking about, basically this entire movie is about like customs and immigration for aliens, and why you shouldn't break the rules, because then you get busted. But then one of the stupid little park ranger guys peeks up over the hill there and sees the alien, and the alien goes running at him like he's going to eat him, because apparently, I mean, he's mad. And then they have to shoot him. But the old guy can't get his gun out in time, so Tommy Lee Jones got to pull his out to shoot the alien before it kills the guy. And it's very dramatic, and he's flying through the air, and then he splats into a big old thing of blue goo. And
it's a really impressive plot, by the way.
It's pretty good, yeah. I mean, it goes, like, every direction. I feel like they use it in more than one instance here. That like, that dispersive, like, floating through the air splatter of goo.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it works because it's not, it is alien. It is unlike human remains. So, it works well for the purposes of the film. And it's not gory in the sense that you're left with organs and stuff like that. You're just left with what sort of looks like jello silly string everywhere, and that lets you have that shift in tone without really being focused on the fact that there's an eviscerated person who's just strewn all over.
They got shiny alien guns too that shoot laser beams or something. They don't even shoot, like, nothing comes out of the gun, does it? It's just sort of just like they pull the trigger and then stuff explodes.
Yeah. In later shots, there's like a plasma ball thing that goes out of it.
Oh, right, the big the shotgun-y looking things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But like, his noisy cricket doesn't, like, emit anything, does it?
I don't think you see a discharge. I think you just see the impact and stuff, because it goes so fast, I assume. So it becomes clear from this scene that the one guy wants to retire. We also get the introduction of the neuralizer that can wipe memories. And
the cleanup team that rolls up in the van and just like burns. Well, they burn most of the alien goo off of like the cactuses and then put it back out, presumably just so people can't get like a DNA sample off of it.
Right, exactly. And the important thing, though, about this is the neuralizer for explaining to the audience how this piece of technology works, because it's going to be used a lot in the film. And they do it in a way that feels natural, because he has to he doesn't have to, but he explains it to the idiot guys who all gather around. He even calls them gullible as he sets it off.
It's one of those things, right? Like, if you can erase somebody's memory, like, why wouldn't you screw them for a little bit beforehand? Like, There's no reason, like, if you get a super top secret job and you can never spill your guts to anyone about it because it's, like, really kind of secretive important, how cool would it be if you could, like, spill your guts to somebody and, like, erase their memory and be like, I feel better now, but at the same time, you don't know my secrets.
Yeah, and it keeps you from having an as-you-know-Bob scene. he doesn't have to explain it to his partner. He doesn't have to explain it in the scene after this or anything. He literally explains it to the victims of this device. They lose their memory of this thing. He says it was a gas explosion. There's the discussion about his partner retiring because he's too old for this. Not in a lethal weapon kind of a way, but just like he's literally too old to be doing this.
No, it's, yeah, he loves the job, loves the chase or whatever. It's actually a pretty heartfelt moment, you know, where he can't keep up, and it's a very important job that, you know, there are very high stakes. So if you can't do it, we're gonna wipe your slate clean and send you packing or whatever.
Yeah, he can be retired with the same device. And after this...
Do you think it also deposits something into his 401k or just, like, cashes it out for him same time?
Well, I'm sure since his last name, since his code name is K, that he's in charge of all the 401s, so, yeah. That's what he does on that fancy keyboard.
It's a small organization. Everyone's got to pull double duty, so he does the accounting and HR work as well.
Yeah, he's got a copy of Quicken. So,
I use QuickBooks myself. Does Quicken still exist?
I don't know. I mean, it was 1996, Dad. When they were filming this,
they hadn't yet purchased a. Well, they own a football stadium, baseball arena. I don't even know. Quicken Loans Arena. What is that?
I have no idea. Isn't it all like Rocket Mortgages or something now? But so they do the thing. They go to Will Smith, who's chasing some guy, and it's a weird chase, and something seems off about this guy. And of course, as the audience, having just witnessed the scene we had witnessed, we know this guy Will Smith is chasing is an alien, but Will Smith does not know that. They get up to a rooftop, and the guy's like, "Yeah, blah 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 blah." Eye slit thing, jump off of the thing because, you know, he's gonna do whatever because I didn't do the thing. I don't know. Who cares?
I love the bad guy's outfit too. It's like the most late 90s looking gear. He's got that like bright green sort of windbreaker thing going on. He's got a lot of piercings and weird little spiky hair.
Yeah. He's got a look, that's for sure. I bet he listens to a lot of club music.
Who was the actor playing that guy? Was that Darth Maul?
No, that was not Ray Park.
Okay.
Somebody kinda looked else.
Like him though, right?
No. It looked like just a guy.
Hmm.
It was not Ray Park. If it was Ray Park, it would sound like Ray Park because Ray Park doesn't do other non-Ray Park voices. The guy falls off the thing. And then Will Smith gives his account of the story to his superiors who don't believe him, and they mock him for his statement. The lady who works in the morgue comes by, says she's got something to show him later. She walks off to the morgue and gets neuralized off camera. And so we know they don't rendezvous. And then
there's some good humor here. Also some good cop humor between, doesn't abide by the rules. Mr. Will Smith, who's wearing like a football jersey basically with his badge and some sort of orange jumpsuit. And then you got your fat, bald, New York looking cops, who have a lot of attitude about how good they are at things.
Yeah. I mean, it feels a little like New York Cop 101 writing.
Yeah, I know, but like it's good that like they're in their own little world where they have their own little squabbles and stuff, and then all of a sudden they're just like, oh, this world is kind of useless and meaningless because it's not really important anymore. Like, I think they do a great job of sort of establishing his world of, you know, policing in New York, and then all of like, oh yeah, all of this is nonsense and useless. So like, let's move on to the bigger problem.
Yeah. So he leaves this and talks to Tommy Lee Jones. And they go visit Jeebs to discuss the thing, the perp, the stuff that the guy had. And Will Smith thinks that he has the upper hand in this scenario because he knows Jeebs and knows that the guy traffics in watches, Rolexes, and stuff like that. And so he thinks that he's going to bust up this petty guy. He goes in there, makes his threats and demands, puts his thing down, I think is what he says he's gonna do.
I'm gonna go up in here and put my thing down. We come back. I want some real answers. And Tommy Lee Jones says, all right, go ahead, put your thing down.
It's
some
like,
good writing for a curmudgeonly old man mixed with Will Smith here.
I really appreciate the writing that they did for Tommy Lee Jones because they didn't make him an incompetent old man, but they also didn't make Will Smith a complete fool or an imbecile who Tommy Lee Jones has to swoop in and help all the time. Like, they really complement each other.
I mean, Will Smith is street smart, and Tommy Lee Jones is space smart? I don't know what you would call it. What are the streets of the space?
Solar winds? I don't know. It's really hard. So anyway, they...
Trajectories?
He
use trajectories with spaceships?
But that's not a, it's not a, like a piece of a thing. Like it's not a set of surface or object or thing you could travel
like
on.
They don't mean like literally like street smart, like he's familiar with the concept of asphalt. They mean like, you know, the streets as a community.
Yes, yes, the trajectories as a community, Dan.
That's what I'm asking. You're the resident space expert on this podcast.
Yeah, yeah, I'm very familiar with trajectories. All the great trajectory suburbs.
You got when they travel in warp, aren't they kind of like in like a warp tube?
No, it's a bubble. Warp a bubble.
So he's bubble smart.
So he threatens Jeebs a little, and then Tommy Lee Jones comes in and he says his stuff and then blows off Jeebs' head. And then this freaks out Will Smith, who thinks that Tommy Lee Jones had just killed somebody. Up from behind the desk, we get the squealing, threatening little...
Oh, this is the second instance where they do that cool sort of like aerated splatter effect.
Yeah, and Jeebs comes up afterwards, all covered in slime as his head slowly expands back, and talks about how much that hurts for the interaction that had just occurred, which surprises Will Smith because it's not normal.
This is the first of a couple slow push-ins as somebody reacts dramatically.
Well, I mean, it's a good technique that you definitely can never, ever overuse. But they have this interaction. And then he reveals the actual inventory, the stock, and pushes a little button, flips over the stuff. There's all these alien guns. Tommy Lee Jones asks Will Smith which one the guy had. And he points to the weird thing that had melted on the rooftop. And then, of course, Tommy Lee Jones knows what that is and how it shouldn't have been sold to an unlicensed cephalopod. Sure. And then Jeebs
must have been for an assassination. Who's the target? But he doesn't know.
Yeah, no, he doesn't know. And they leave there, at which time Tommy Lee Jones neuralizes Will Smith, and then he snaps to it inside of a Chinese restaurant. Mm-hmm. And they're having Chinese food.
Which is very weird, though, because like Tommy Lee Jones is telling some sort of funny story. It sounds like he's telling it about an alien or something still, but Will Smith has no idea. He says, you're a bright young man, but you can't hold your tequila or something. It's like, wait a minute, the table is littered with like Tsingtao bottles. Like, why are you doing tequila shots in a Chinese restaurant?
No. That's what they did before they went to the Chinese restaurant. They were hungry.
Is that what it was?
Yeah.
I know I like to do shots of tequila before I go have Chinese food.
Yeah, well, it's all about matching the you want to get the proper pairing. Mm-hmm.
Tequila before beer, you're in the clear. Beer before tequila. I don't know.
I was waiting for you to try to rhyme that.
But the aliens are going to kill you or something. I don't know. You just put something, just go back and post here and then like insert something witty.
Yeah, I shan't.
Just do a little J cut or whatever.
No. But
good game here. Good playing along.
Yeah, that's... I'll do a K cut.
It's not a thing. You got J and you got L.
No. But the characters in the movie.
No, I got it. I'm just saying.
Did you?
I take my editing very seriously.
Yeah. I look forward to your book, Editing A to Z.
I like Zed in this movie. Rip Torn, he's good.
Yeah. This is before Rip Torn lost his marbles and did some stuff.
No. What did Rip Torn do? Do I know this?
I don't know if you know what Rip Torn did. Just look it up later.
Oh, God. Was it before or after Dodgeball?
It was after Dodgeball. I think it was after the second season of Third Rock. Third Rock, not Third.
Third Rock from the Sun.
No,
he's got aliens on the mind.
No, it was 30 Rock. He played Jack Donaghy's boss, and then he mysteriously was not around anymore. There was a reason. But
is this the thing where he drunkenly broke into a building with an unlicensed firearm?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, as you can imagine. Less than employable after that.
He said he lived there. Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, Rip Torn, good in this movie. Let's leave it at that.
He's a bit of an elder statesman these days. Maybe he kind of got a little confused.
We'll digitally replace him with Christopher Plummer. But
can I be digitally replaced with Christopher Plummer too? Because that sounds like way better.
Sure. He played General Chang in Star Trek VI, so I'd gladly talk to Christopher Plummer. One of these days we're going to do that movie. That's a threat.
He's also in Girl with Dragon Tattoo.
He's in lots of things. He was in some terrible movie about like a late in life coming out where he had a boyfriend, but then he died, and it was about his son dealing with the death. And I was just like, ugh, this is bad. Like, I couldn't even make it like through 30 minutes of the film. I was just like, this is so awful. Even though it's free, I'm not going to watch you. But
you never saw Dragon Tattoo, did you?
No, I didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, most people didn't say it was all that good, so.
It's a good movie. It just makes you feel really bad about everything, so don't, like, yeah.
Yeah, I have a lot of bandwidth for feeling really bad about everything.
Yeah, it just leaves you with a gross feeling. He's been in a lot of movies.
Christopher Plummer has been in a ton. For a long time, too.
211 credits for acting.
It's more than me, I'll tell you that.
Definitely, yeah. Mm-hmm. Would you say you've worked on how many movies and TV shows that would you say you've worked on?
I haven't starred in all that many, so.
Well, I'm just saying within the realm of your particular expertise.
Oh,
is your IMDb up to date? I'll look you up.
I don't think it's up to date. It probably has all my movies, but not all the TV things.
You are not Joseph Rosenberg.
No, I would say that would not be my name. It's your first clue.
You worked on a short film?
Did I?
Girl Number Two? In 2016?
Did I?
I don't think so.
I don't know. Maybe?
Interesting. Directed by David Jeffrey?
I had no idea.
2016 short movie called Girl Number Two. Apparently, that's your most recent credit aside from Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. Two.
Oh. Oh, I think I know what that is. Yeah.
Did you do that?
When I was at Fuse, there was like a project that was a film. But
was it somebody's like passion project that just needed a little bit of help?
I think so. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The important thing here is that Christopher Plummer has been in a lot of things, and Rip Torn was in this. And back to the movie. He has his little chat with Will Smith where he like fakes that they had been hanging out all night and then leaves him with the card. Will Smith decides to go follow up on this in the next morning and goes to the Battery Park
air it's processing like the tunnel authority people for trains or something.
Yeah, and so he walks into this room that is just a giant fan on one side and a giant vent on the other side. This one guy sitting there reading a paper in a chair.
By the way, I love that guy is in... I think he's in all three of the movies. He's definitely in the first two.
Yeah, I remember him in the second one. I didn't see the third. He walks past him to the elevator, goes down, and there is a test that's being conducted. They're all sitting in those very mod... egg chairs from the 60s, and a test is distributed for them all to take, and they're all military people of various sorts, and then NYPD portrayed just by Will Smith, and there is a diverse array of qualified candidates who are represented there at this meeting.
You and your armies, your navies, your Green Berets, I don't know, all the great military folk.
Yes. All the great challenge coins.
Special forces in uniforms and such. I don't know why they all showed up in their dress blues or whatever.
Just to show off. So they all start taking their test, but it becomes obvious that the test is not about the test that they're filling out on paper, but about problem solving, how to fill out the test, because Will Smith is the only one who figures out that he can just take the coffee table thing over to his side so he can sit down and fill it out like normal.
And Tommy everyone's Jones. Breaking pencils and poking holes in the paper and trying to write against the side of their egg chair, and it's not working out very well.
No, but he figures this out. But I love the way they drew out the scraping metal noise of this heavy coffee table over the terrazzo floor.
Plus, there's like, there's a, you know, most of the scene is underscored with like a loud whooshing from like the fan kind of sound, and all of the sound cuts off except for that screeching noise when he starts dragging it.
Yes, and it just goes on for forever. It is perfectly timed. Much in the way last week that we had talked about how poorly timed the comedy editing was in Wild Wild West, the timing of the comedy editing here, impeccable. So he goes to fill out the thing. Then they cut to their next test, which is a shooting test, gun range test. I mean, it's not really a gun range. They just have targets that flip up on a course.
It's a gun range. It's a shooting. Well, they've got a small table with pistols in a circle on it, which is not a very safe way to leave firearms, especially loaded ones. And then, yeah, you got little monsters popping out. You got strobe lights. I don't know what part of their job they really have to do with strobe lights, but they start shooting at stuff. And he's just sort of like looking around like, why are there cardboard cutouts of monsters? And then the test is like basically over, and he fires one shot right through the forehead of a little 8-year-old girl carrying some books.
And I love Rip Torn's questions about this. It's like, why
did you think little Tiffany deserved to die?
Oh, so good. And we're all laughing in the audience because we think that's ridiculous. But then we hear Will Smith's explanation of, like, what is this little girl doing in this neighborhood with all these monsters around with these quantum physics books? Like, that's the unusual thing. And this is, again, another thing about him doing this test correctly. And he goes and confers with Tommy Lee Jones, who says, yeah, you know, it's got to be him. And he's like, he's got a problem with authority. He's like, so do I, whatever.
Well, it's another one of the good lines is, you know, and I appreciate if you back up off my case about it, or do I owe her an apology? Because, you know, he at least recognizes that he's there for the test and Mr. Zed is in charge, but he's, you know, he's going to try to talk his way out of it with his ego. And then if all else fails, maybe then he'll apologize.
Yeah, no. And he doesn't know that he is doing this correctly. He's just going off of his instincts.
Well, he still doesn't even know why he's there. So he doesn't know, like, why he's trying to impress anyone or what he's trying out for. He's like tripping and falling and stumbling his way through the test and still sort of showing off his character as best he possibly can.
Yeah. And afterwards, Rip Torn says there's just an eye exam, which will be the last portion of the test. And they all go out of the room. Tommy Lee Jones waits until Will Smith comes out, flags him down to talk to him about it, tells him all about aliens and stuff and how they've had contact with them for a long time and they've disguised their ships. This is your first reference to the flying saucers in Queens. And they talk about how they are in charge of making sure that all this stuff works out and that people will panic if they ever found out the truth because they can't really handle this stuff. They walk past the room where the eye exam is being administered. Of course, it's a neuralizer and all their memories are being wiped. And Will Smith doesn't believe any of this and he says it's all BS, blah, 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 blah. They go to, Tommy Lee Jones says, oh, I'm just going to grab some coffee. Do you mind if I grab some coffee? Do you want some coffee? Goes inside the room. There are all the rod puppets, who are the aliens hanging out with the, coffee. And apparently they put cinnamon in the coffee, which is, I don't know why.
Don't do that, basically. Yeah.
Yes. It's not a good thing. I mean, this is probably the precursor to bullet coffee. If they were making this movie nowadays, you'd probably the aliens would probably be putting a big pat of butter in.
I was at the Safeway yesterday trying to pick up something for dinner to help make something, and the very talkative new girl behind the register was imparting to me how good her new chestnut something frappuccino was, and I should really go get one. It was really delicious, and I informed her that the only thing that should go in coffee is coffee. the guy next to me goes, yep, that's I agree with him. And she's like, well, frappuccino. I'm like, no, it's a milkshake. It's fine if you want a milkshake. He's like, yep, I'm with this guy. I'm like, oh god, the 55-year-old man who's buying like all his food with tons of coupons and looks like he's gonna go home and put to his chat or something. Like, that's me. Yeah, why am I agreeing with this guy?
How many cans of Fancy Feast did he have?
I didn't look at his. But, like, you know, he's one of these guys who bought a couple of groceries and they got cash back. He got like $70 in cash back in like 20s, 10s, and 5s. I'm like, what are you doing? Get out of here. We all have things to do with our lives.
Yeah, yeah.
This is me now, apparently. I'm no longer one of the young millennials who wants to put whipped cream on all of my things. I'm just like grumpy old guy who needs my caffeine and get off my lawn.
Well, I mean, I think you had that grumpy old guy in you all along. But the
maybe.
Speaking of grumpy old guys and coffee, he gets his coffee, and Will Smith is suitably shocked by this, and then he goes and talks to him at a park bench outside.
He didn't even go in to see if like they were Muppets or whatever, if there were wires holding up the worm guys or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, because if he had just gone in and tugged on them, they wouldn't have come off the wall, because that was hiding all the all the puppetry. Will Smith and Tommy Jones sit down at the park bench, looking out on, what is it, Hudson River? Whatever, who cares? It's New York. And they're talking about, you know, how people would panic, you know, a person, you know, is smart, people are stupid, that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice scene, because it explains the logic of this institution existing in a way that makes sense, because then you think and you're like, oh yeah, that's right, people are stupid, because everybody would panic, and it seems logical that this would be there. It doesn't seem like the kind of thing that you would be very skeptical of, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. And basically, he's got the ultimatum at this point, which is like, look, we want to work with you, it would be great if you came and worked for us, but by the way, not only can you not like tell anyone what you're doing, like, we're going to literally erase your identity from the face of the earth, so you like don't exist, because it's just, it would be too easy to track you down, or I don't know, track down family members or something, and like, you know, get the information out of you. So we have to like remove all connection to the outside world, which is a big commitment. You got to say goodbye to your family and friends and all that stuff, and just give it up, and you're gonna come fight aliens with us or whatever.
Yep. And he says you got to do it by what is it, sunrise tomorrow morning?
Sure. Otherwise, yeah. They got to go find some new candidates.
He turns into a pumpkin.
Yeah, exactly. Which, that's another one of the things about this movie. Like, I don't want to jump ahead too far, but, like, the timeline of this movie is really weird. It's very,
very strange.
Because, like, towards the end of the movie, like, when they're fighting the bug, again, well, there's more to do, but, like, he says, like, you know, not bad for your second day of work or whatever.
Yeah.
And then, like, literally 5 minutes later, he's like, no, I haven't been training a partner. I've been training a replacement. It's like, what? 2 days? That's the training period? Like, there's longer training to work at the Department of Transportation.
Yeah. This seems insufficient for training, but it did feel kind of rushed that they wanted to get to the ending that they got to, but not to get ahead of ourselves.
Yeah,
this
that was
ultimatum
the only thing that felt weird, that like in terms of time, I had to point that out now, because we're kind of building to that, and like it brings it back to the beginning or whatever, but it felt weird.
Yeah, it feels very weird. But this is important, because we're also going to see a scene here of a farmhouse and a starry night sky and some cows and a truck. And I love the way this is composed and timed and written. This shot works flawlessly.
Yeah, you're 50 yards outside this little shack. You can hear Vincent D'Onofrio in there shouting at his wife for making a terrible dinner, and he's complaining about everything, and, you know,
My favorite part is when he says, all I want is a steak. And, you know, what is this? This is poison. I bet this is poison. And he's like, what are you doing? Don't take that away. I'm eating that.
It is poison, isn't it? Yeah. And then eventually he gets around to, the only thing that pulls its weight around here is my truck. And like right as he says that, what appears to be a shooting star or something comes out of the sky and crashes into his truck, tearing it in half and putting a giant hole in the ground. And
yes.
Then he pops his head out of the front screen door and says, figures. And wanders out to go see what happened. He's got his little shotgun because, you know, he's country bumpkin farmer guy, and who knows what could be out there. A weird sort of muffled, almost robotic sounding voice from the hole says, please put down your weapon. It sounds like RoboCop, basically. And he says, you can have my gun when you pry from my cold, dead hand. And the voice says, that is acceptable. And then grabs him by the face and yanks him down into the hole and eats him and spits out his skin onto the dirt in a very kind of, It's like horrifying, but it's also not very gory.
No, it's very clean for what it is, if you're thinking about it.
He licked it clean with his alien bug tongue.
Well, also clean and dry, because it just looks like a latex Mike Myers costume.
So you're saying it was a dry clean. He's got a dry cleaner down there in his little space thing.
Sure.
But he didn't use any starch, because that would give it away.
Yeah, exactly. And it would probably keep the skin from separating, because it would probably just gum up the works there. You want to probably use something like a lipid, maybe to increase the lubrication.
You ever do the dry cleaning? Do you roll? Do you roll starch? Do you do high starch, low starch, medium starch?
I starch shirts, but I don't starch anything else.
What do you do on your starch? How do you starch your shirts?
Light starch.
Light starch. Hmm.
It's been a while. I usually just give Jason all my shirts, and I'd have him take them. But he doesn't do any starch, so that's kind of annoying.
Oh, he's a no-starcher. Interesting.
Yeah. But
I feel like that's a holdover from like the 80s and 90s, like business working class man, the medium and the heavy starches, but, it's their thing. They ask you, you want the starch. So like, I don't know. It feels weird to say like, no, I feel like you're getting shortchanged.
It's free
or something.
Starch. Yeah.
Yeah, it's free starch right there. You can't ask for like starch on the side or something.
No. You let the starch go to waste.
It's not a Cobb salad. You can't like take it to go.
Yes. No, I just think that it helps with the wrinkliness of them, which is the reason why the people do that stuff, although it makes it incredibly stiff if you go for something like a heavy starch. But that's not really a concern for the Edgar suit, because that gets spat back up onto the little mound there, and then gets dragged back into the mound. And then up comes Vincent D'Onofrio in some light makeup. and I say light makeup because there's heavier makeup to come. What they basically did is made it look like his skin was sagging off of him.
Yeah, it's the alien is wearing his suit, wearing his skin like a suit, an Edgar suit, as the wife says. But that I think that's one of my favorite like subtle makeup things in this movie. Like over the course of the movie, it gets worse and worse. Like as his skin is basically rotting because it is dead. And it just gets grosser and like more like green and brown and like slouchy, and until he eventually just tears it off and throws it away. But it's kind of it's very nicely done.
Yeah, and the contacts and stuff. There is, when he's finally completely rotting, there is a little flap of skin from his lip that is dangling there, and it is quite something. But in this opening part here, he's mostly one piece. He goes inside to talk to his wife and says that he wants some sugar and stuff. And then he does the thing where he pulls the back of his head and stretches it, somewhat iconic for this film, and frightens the wife so that she faints.
So it's a good effect. Was that practical effect right there?
No, that was not.
Mm. How'd they do that? They do that with some spline warps?
They did with some spline warps. I don't think they had spline warps, but yes, they that was all computer stuff. But back to the introduction of Will Smith to the headquarters. He gets his briefing. He walks through the thing. They go down to the elevator. The elevator, for whatever reason, was a big deal. I don't know why. It's just some circles on a wall with a thing that goes down the side.
Production design. It's interesting.
Yeah, and it's in the music video.
Let's not talk about that.
Yeah, he goes down to the bottom, and they walk through the place, and it's all very mod, very 60s. There are, again, the flying saucers on the wall, and he gets shown around to the sort of room full of gadgets, I guess. I'm not sure what the purpose of showing him that was, but he says
it's because he's asking who they report to, and he said nobody. And basically, he says they own the patent on a couple of very important gadgets, and that's how they pay the bills, like Velcro and stuff like that. So
Velcro and microwave ovens.
Yeah, exactly.
He knocks this little ball thing, which goes blasting through the whole entire place, hits people, stuff, breaks things, goes into a room that's basically just glass, blows past Rip Torn in a way that he dodges without looking, which is interesting. And
I think on everyone's first day, they usually hit the ball on accident.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, you want to hit the ball out of the park on the first day.
I feel like that's an unreasonable expectation for somebody's first day. It's a lot of pressure.
I know, but
just want to be a team player. Like, you know, put the ball on the ground a couple of times, get a couple of runs batted in, and then contribute something to the score.
Okay.
There's baseball metaphors there.
Okay.
You like baseball?
Do you know where my baseball knowledge ended?
T-ball?
No, I was going to say the first thing that I said.
Hit it out of the park?
Yeah, that was it.
Mm.
The rest of that, you lost me. But
you didn't play T-ball when you were a little kid?
I mean, I did. I don't remember any of the rules.
There's bases, and you hit the ball,
mm-hmm.
and there's running, and some throwing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a simple game.
You stand on the base.
You throw the ball, you hit the ball, you catch the ball.
Yeah, there's some nuance to it, though.
That's a quote from the movie. Anyway, moving on.
Yes.
He breaks all the stuff, and then he apologizes to people.
Yeah, yeah. He'll pay for it, etc.
This is where they go over to the computer to see Wu Yang and Bob and all of the celebrities up on the big screen there who are aliens being actively monitored. And, oh, isn't it hilarious? You got Stallone up there, and I don't remember who else was up there.
George
Lucas was up there. I think Spielberg was in the corner, too, wasn't he?
I don't remember seeing Spielberg, but he could have been. This is an Amblin movie.
Top left, yeah. Yeah, there are a couple others. And then, you know, he said, you know, he does the thing, like, I thought my... teacher in third grade or whatever was from Jupiter or something, and or from Venus, and he's like, no, he was from one of the Jupiter moons or whatever, Mrs. Edelston, and they bring her up on the camera there. It's very interesting. She has a camera like floating directly in front of her face, which is apparently nobody in the classroom noticed, but whatever.
There's some interesting camera moves that the MIB equipment can do.
Mm-hmm.
We will get to in a later scene.
what's the other one? I don't remember.
Remember when he types in name of
his former girlfriend, where it comes straight down from a satellite, and then it's like sort of at this like 30-degree tilt angle from behind a tree somehow,
and then follows her.
Right, exactly. It's not as directly from a satellite. Like the satellite deployed some sort of drone to hover around behind a tree,
but to just slowly enhance, and then get down to the bottom and just be handheld camera work.
Well, it was back in the day of progressive JPEGs. You know, compression wasn't as sophisticated as it is now. So, there's no HVEC or whatever. HEVC. I don't know what the acronym is. Stupid acronym.
High efficiency video codec.
Yeah, you would
HEVC.
You'd think Men in Black would want to own the patent on H265 because that's going to be the way of the future. You're gonna have to buy the.
Maybe they did. They just didn't have a line for it in the movie.
You'll have to buy the music video for the White Album again.
That was funny that they thought discs would go anywhere.
Optical media is hilarious.
LOL. But they talk about stuff and how they need to go check out a thingy.
Well, he's got to put a suit on first too, and then, you know.
Yeah, the last suit you'll ever wear.
Yeah, I make this look good, which is not. It's not the last suit I'll ever wear. I'm pretty sure because, you know, he wears another suit at the end of the movie too.
Yes. A worse suit.
A very, very 90s, very terrible suit. Plus, I love that, what's her name? The morgue lady. She's got a double-breasted suit on. It's like the pinnacle of fashion right there. It's just so bad.
No, it's...
A slim-cut, double-breasted suit.
She just looks like a waitress on a cruise ship or something. Like
she just needs one of those like puffy leather hats, and she could be like a limo driver.
Not great, but they determine that they have to go chase down these people who are running through the border thing and stuff. They go drive over there. They catch the guy who played Quillick in Galaxy Quest. Who will play Quillick in Galaxy Quest because that's still several years away from happening.
It's a time paradox. How does that work?
Well, you can go back 13 seconds of time or until this movie. But they're talking about why they're leaving town and how they're scared and, you know, stuff's not going great with the neighborhood. And while he's talking to Quillick about the stuff, the wife who was in labor has had a tentacle emerge from her, wrap itself around Will Smith, smash him into the top and sides and ground, and then drag him in and out of the vehicle and then deposit him on the other side with the baby in his arms.
Right. And this is sort of connected to the plot because before they left, there was some sort of report about an unscheduled landing, which they need to go investigate. But before they can do that, they got something pop up on their big little display thing there saying, somebody's outside their zone, so go get this guy first. And he's quizzing him on like, is this you're leaving town? Doesn't have anything to do with what happened yesterday, does it? He's like, oh, I have no idea what you're talking about. But you can tell he does. You can tell he does. And then, you know, he spits out a baby pops out with Will Smith, and he congratulates him on his new baby squid.
Yeah, and it throws up all over Will Smith.
I forget there was some sort of technological first and or advancement for that whole scene where the tentacles are banging him onto the roof. Was that a digital double or something, or was that wire work? I don't even remember.
I don't know. It was sophisticated for the time, but
it looks a little stop motiony.
Yeah, doesn't look great. But the important thing, like you said, was it has elements of something that moves the plot forward. Meanwhile, back at the farm, Edgar has come across the exterminator who's come to the farm to kill all the bugs that are in there. Edgar does not like this. And there is a weird conversation that the two of them have about the inferior species and stuff. And then he jams the exterminator pesticide wand thing down the exterminator's throat. And then green gas spews out of him because that's apparently how the movie thinks that works. But that's not very movie trope of having you see that invisible gas.
If this wasn't signifying the character's motivations or anger enough, there was also that brief thing earlier when he was talking about the universal translator before Will Smith hit the ball through the wall and the window and the glass and stuff. He said that the human language is so primitive it's viewed as an infectious disease by some people. So clearly there are aliens out there who are not fans of humanity and or their plans to regulate alien behavior on the planet. And Mr. Edgar Alien is definitely one of those.
Yeah. And so he kills the guy, and then he takes his ship and rolls it inside of the exterminator's van and then drives off in that. Meanwhile, back in New York.
You said they're like super friends. Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice. Anyway, sorry.
And then you have those wishy star things.
Oh, the three of them with the...
Yeah. Those were so cool.
It was cool because, like, the first two missed a little bit offside of the camera, and the third one comes right into the camera as a star wipe.
Yeah. Worked really well. That's why they kept reusing it so often, because it was so good.
It was like 30 of them per episode.
Yeah. Saves a lot of money when you can reuse something like that. They go to the farm to talk to... Oh, I'm sorry. First, they go to the newsstand, collect tabloids, which Will Smith is critical of Tommy Lee Jones for doing, because, you know, what are you going to find in there? There's all this stuff. And he's like, oh, you could read the New York Times. They get one right every so often or something like that. But, you know, this is the best way to find something. And here you go. Look at this.
Yeah.
Alien stole my husband's skin. And so they go drive up there. They find the crash site and the wife. They talk to her. She offers them lemonade. I love the actress who plays this role. I forget her name, but she's a character actress who's been in quite a few other things. But she seems sort of, I don't know, detached, but also befuddled by everything. I quite appreciate her delivery of some of the stuff, especially when she has to act like she's been neuralized and just sit there staring blankly and blink. She does a good job of blinking. Mm-hmm. And
I know why you can't remember her name, because I don't even know how to pronounce this name. It's Siobhan Fallon Hogan. Siobhan.
Sure.
I don't know how you say that, but that's her name.
I've seen her in lots of stuff. She's good.
Yeah, she's very good.
They have the thing there. Will Smith spits his lemonade back inside the cup. Presumably it's poison. And they come to realize that the husband is probably not of this earth. They neuralize her, and Kay gives kind of a crummy excuse for why they're there, and Will Smith is like, no, you know, you gotta give her like some big deal, like you left him, he didn't leave you, now you go buy yourself something nice, you buy yourself some nice shoes, a nice dress, Bloomingdale's, you know, take care of yourself, and then what did he say, like, do something about this place.
You get an interior decorator up in here, because damn. It's very Will Smith. He does some good Will Smithing in this movie.
Yeah, it, like as we had discussed in our episode about Wild Wild West, people hired Will Smith to be this sort of version of Will Smith that you see here, and he didn't fit inside of Wild Wild West at all. But he's very natural to this, because it's really our world in our time. in 96. So everything about it was okay.
Yeah, he's the Fresh Prince of the Galaxy or whatever. Like, he's good in this movie.
Yes. And they go out and Kay does a soil sample test and he's like, oh, you know what? One craves sugar water and leaves a green spectral trail. And he's like, why are you asking me?
That was on Jeopardy last night.
Yeah.
Glenn would know.
Yeah. Oh, Glenn. But no. They he says it's a bug and they're gonna do stuff, and so it's bad that they have a bug. It calls Zed, says
he
that
has a nice little slim phone there with an antenna on and a flip down on the front, and it doesn't
very impressive by 96 standards.
Yeah, it doesn't need to dial. It's so fast to connect. He just flips it open, says we got a bug, and then closes it back up, and like, wow, message delivered. Apparently that was quick.
Yeah, psychic dialing. So they head back, and this is where you get the guy leaving the jewelry shop with his cat, and he rendezvous with the guy who played Lurch.
That's Lurch. I was like, yeah. I've seen that facial structure before.
Yeah, and he also played Mr. Holmes in Star Trek The Next Generation, Laxana Troy's servant, who is mute.
Mm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought you would want to know that.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. So he's played aliens a couple times. But they go to the pierogi place and they're sitting down and they're talking in their weird alien language about stuff. And he's giving him diamonds for his kids. And they're talking about the galaxy.
Some good looking pierogies, by the way.
I mean, before they have cockroaches on them, they look pretty good.
Comes with
Although
a side of like applesauce and like sour cream, I think.
I prefer my pierogies fried, though.
Yeah, you know, I do too, I think, but we recently we got a batch of some of the fancy Costco ones. Cause
Costco ones.
It's seasonal. They only sell them for, you know, like 60 days out of the year, so get as much as you can now. You know, we boil those ones up.
You don't want to have pierogies when they're not growing ripe off the tree.
That's exactly right. we boiled those up, and they were good. I enjoyed them. They were still fluffy and delicious. But I do enjoy the like a nice like a pan fried one.
Well, I mean, you can when you have the pan fried ones, all you're doing is you're taking the boiled pierogies and then you're just frying them in butter.
Right? I know.
Can solve that problem.
We could, yeah. You know, and that's what we normally do when we buy frozen bags of dumplings from places, but. We decided to go with the boiled ones this time. Anyway,
so
much suggest you go to Costco and try these out when they're there because they have like five different flavors. I like the jalapeno ones, but you know they were a little too spicy for like buying a whole bag of them.
I don't have a Costco membership.
Oh well, you can borrow ours. It's fine.
Okay, good talk. But they have this thing where the chef puts up the plates for table number 7, I think he says, and then you hear Edgar's voice off screen, Vincent D'Onofrio's voice, and then he reaches in with his arms and grabs them and pulls them out and says that the other guy is what did he say? He's on a break.
He said he gave him a break and then
gave him a break.
As the camera pulls away, you can see that he's broken in half and stuffed into a shelf.
Yeah. This is a good shot. It's not gory in that you're seeing like intestines everywhere or anything, but it is unsettling in that there's someone who looks like a human being folded in half. And then at the table, he comes by and he puts down the pierogi plate and some of the roaches crawl out of his sleeve and land on the plate. And immediately the aliens know that this is a bug who is going to kill them. And he says that you'll never find the galaxy. And then he says, you're right about one of those things. And then he kills him, with some spike thing through the neck. I have a question about that.
Mm-hmm.
What part of the alien's anatomy was in the neck?
How did he kill them by doing that?
Yes.
I mean, presumably he just, sort of severed the spinal cord, which I, you know, may not have a spinal cord in it, but maybe it's got some important optical cables connecting to the body.
How did that kill the little guy?
Maybe there's some pseudo functioning lungs that pumped oxygen into the head cavity thing.
No, she said all that stuff was missing.
Did she say the lungs were missing? Yeah, I think she did, didn't she?
Mm-hmm.
Well, so, I mean, you know, a spike went through the thing, and we don't yet know that there's a little guy inside the big guy's head, so it just it plays for cinematic purposes.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just saying that upon closer examination.
Upon closer examination, this movie about aliens and cockroaches from space has a couple of logic flaws.
Yes, just a couple. But so he snatches what we know of as the little case full of diamonds and runs out the door. And then he has this weird nonchalant walk while he's sort of like limping along and moving his arm out to the side in this sort of rictus of pain, it seems like.
He's attempting to casual on the streets of New York, and everyone's staring at him because he's wearing an apron and his skin is rotting, and people are yelling at him for doing bad things in the restaurant.
Yeah. What I like about this is he seems to be deteriorating and losing control over the sort of skin sack that he's occupying as time goes on. Or I guess maybe he's just like his legs falling asleep because he's so compressed down inside of there or something. But yeah, he just moves more and more jerky and alien and weird as the movie progresses.
And presumably, and sure, he's also very uncomfortable crammed in that little outfit.
Yeah, yeah. And he gets back to like the van and he's smashing everything up and he can't get the thing open, and he finally opens it up. And it's just a bunch of diamonds, and he's all peeved about that one.
Mm-hmm. Drops them on the floor, gets all angry.
Yeah. Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Meanwhile, I can't do that voice. I feel like that's a famous voice actor that does that too.
Probably. But they're like, well, what do we do? And all these people are freaked out and they're leaving, so that has to be a big deal. And we got a bug and stuff. And so, hey, zoom out on all of our satellites. Oh, crap, there's an alien battlecruiser. And it's, you know, now it's going to blast demands to us about the galaxy. And it's the Arkellian whatever thing. And they go to the morgue. They find the dead Arkellian guys who were there. Tommy Jones is over Lurch's body, and then Will Smith and Linda Fiorentino go over to talk about the other one, and she saying, oh, she's having deja vu because she feels like she's seen him before. And we as the audience are like, LOL, your brains have been messed with. And they stumble upon the mechanism to open up the ear on the Arkellian guy, and inside is the tiny, tiny little alien, who is a tiny, tiny little puppet, who was digitally composited into the shot, and it worked pretty well.
Yeah, it looks good.
And the cute little alien guy is talking about how they have to get the galaxy on Orion's, and then he's like searching for the war word for this stuff, and he keeps stumbling, and so they helped him with war, and
prevent war, the galaxy's on Orion's belts. But he's clearly English is not his primary language since he's an Arkellian, so he's struggling, and they're trying to interpret it. He's dying breaths, and you know what is he trying to say? And then all of a sudden he dies, and all the little fuzzy TV screens inside of his head spaceship thing go black. And then Will Smith finally yells over to Tommy Lee Jones. I don't know why he didn't do it sooner. Like,
no,
hey, come over here.
Doesn't make any sense.
Like, I know you were in a hurry or whatever because he's like dying or something. But calls Tommy Lee Jones over and he goes, "Ah, oh, Rosenberg. He was one of the famous ones or whatever." And then
the Arkellian prince or something, yeah. Royal family.
And then morgue lady's like, "Ah, oh, you guys probably aren't with the health department, are you? If you know that this is an alien and stuff." And then he's like, oh, you're still here. And then he neuralizes her real fast. And then they start having like a side conversation. And she comes out of the neuralization. She's like, hey, what are you doing here? And she's like, oh, sorry, here's the answer to the question. And he just neuralizes her again. And Will Smith starts yelling, like, would you stop that? You're going to give her brain cancer or something. It's like, huh, whatever. And she just wakes up again and he neuralizes her for like a third time or something. And then on their way out, they're yelling at each other. He's like, aren't you worried about long-term damage? A little bit. Have you ever neuralized me? No. I'm not playing with you. Have you ever neuralized me? No.
Like, yes. I love that because it's not true.
he doesn't care, and he just has no no interest in like having that conversation.
And there's no reason to tell him. And so they go out and they brief the cleanup crew guys on what they got to do. Will Smith pleads with them, but he says, okay, fine, a happy memory to leave for the morgue lady. They get out of there, go off to check out the jewelry shop, I think. And they can't find anything in there because it's already been trashed by Bug Dude, and he couldn't find anything.
It was only in there for like 5 seconds, and then like his truck was getting towed by another fat, disheveled New York stereotype, and then he points a shotgun at him, and then the guy's like, "Don't even bother. I got a gun here too, stuffed into my little."
What was that, like a Colt 45 or something?
I don't know. It's like a 50 cal revolver or something, like a 357 Magnum. And he basically
it was
the
ridiculous gun.
Don't even try it, buddy, because I got one too. And then he's like, "Well, he's an alien. He's just gonna shoot you because he doesn't care," which he does. And then he drives the tow truck away. And then Will Smith starts shooting his noisy cricket at him and blows a giant hole in the side of a semi truck. And somewhere along there, when he's swerving or whatever, he like crashes the tow truck into something, and then his bug truck with his spaceship in it like falls off, and they capture it. And Tommy Lee Jones yells at him for don't discharge your weapon in front of the public. He's like, "Dude, we don't have time for this. There's a spaceship up there." He's like, "Yeah, that's literally always going on because it's a secret. Because if we told everyone that like the world was about to end, it would be bad news. So don't freak out. Like, keep it calm. You know, the world's gonna end in like a day, but it's fine."
Yeah, and then he's like, "And besides, we got a spaceship. He's not going anywhere." Which is only because Will Smith had freaked out. So I don't know. You should give him more credit for that. But the bug had seen a photo of the cat that had the thing around its neck and pieced it together that was the thing that they were looking for. Back at the morgue, Linda Fiorentino is looking at the little marble thing on the cat's necklace, and she's like, "Oh, your name's Orion. What a coincidence." And then the audience were like, "Oh, it's Orion in Orion's belt." And it's like, yes, we already knew that. But they look at it, and she apparently has magnifier eyes that let her zoom in slowly into it and realize that it's a galaxy inside of the marble. And it lights up inside of her eyes in a very phony baloney kind of a way. And at the desk out front is David Cross, and he meets Bug Dude, who wants to go in and talk to a very dear friend of his and get his cat. And he says he's got to have this paperwork and blah, 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 blah. And meanwhile, he's swatting all these flies that are inside of the thing with a fly swatter. And the bug guy is freaked out by it and says, "You know, please stop doing that." And the bug guy wants to get in and out of there with as little friction as possible. But at a certain point, he can't take it anymore when David Cross takes out two cans of what appears to be versions of Raid that you could use on screen without having to give Raid any money.
it's got like his big yellow thing, and there's like a picture of a bug with a big X on it or something.
Yeah, and so he sprays the bug spray stuff, and then we never see David Cross alive for the rest of the film. And
until the next movie.
And so in walk Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones, first they're outside, and he says, Will Smith says to Tommy Lee Jones, I'm going to go take care of this because, you know, you're going to freak her out and stuff. We're just getting a cat. It's not a big deal. You stay out here. I don't have to, you know, neuralize her 5,000 times. So he goes inside, doesn't see a guy at the desk, rings the thing, yells, and this tips off the dude in the back who's captured Linda Fiorentino and who is trying to get the cat and get her to give him the cat. Will Smith walks to the back, sees Linda Fiorentino standing there. It starts talking to her. Camera pans down, reveals bug underneath the thing. Linda Fiorentino says that she needs to get out of there and stuff, but in a sexually suggestive way, which Will Smith takes to mean as sexually suggestive. I mean, in all fairness to Will Smith, she could have delivered that line a little differently.
Yeah, but it's LOL comedy, whatever, playing to Will Smith's ego, and how funny is that, that he misinterpreted it, and blah, blah, blah. But eventually, you know, she's becoming increasingly less subtle, and then the cat lands on the board or whatever, and up comes Vincent D'Onofrio's arm, grabs the cat, then grabs Morgue Lady and puts the gun up to her and like backs out and starts hiding. Meanwhile, in the hallway, for the first time in the entire movie, Tommy Lee Jones decides to light up a cigarette, also indoors. But like right as he lights the match, like some bug goo drips down onto the fire and puts it out, and he looks up to see David Cross like glued to the ceiling with, I don't know, some form of bug goo. It's kind of gross.
Yeah. Yeah. And then he goes running down the hallway. They confront him, the guy, and he takes the thing off of the cat, holds it in his hand, holds Linda Fiorentino, jumps out of a window that goes up to the street level. And then
he's a frog.
Well, I mean, they have powerful hind legs. And so they leave to go chase him down. Will Smith is chasing on foot. Tommy Lee Jones gets his car, and Tommy Lee Jones pulls up, picks up Will Smith and says, you know, he's not going anywhere. He doesn't have a ship. Cause remember that's gone. And so they're trying to figure out what the bug's next move is back at the headquarters. And they Will Smith pieces together, you know, that the alien might be trying to use some other means of transportation that could be unaccounted for, like those structures on, in Queens from the World's Fair. And they're on that big mural and had been referenced 3 times so far in this film. Mm-hmm. So he just yells, hey, old dudes. And they finally turn around and he says, those things still work. And then they grab their stuff and get to the car.
Because in the meantime, the Arculean battleship is said to deliver the galaxy or will destroy Earth, because apparently it's very important that this galaxy not be turned over to a bug alien race or whatever, because reasons. So they'll destroy Earth to protect it.
It's an efficient source of subatomic energy.
Oh, is that the justification? I must have missed that.
And that is relayed by Frank the Pug.
Oh, okay, sure, right. Frank the Pug is in this movie.
Yeah, we neglected to talk about Frank the Pug.
Did we?
Did we? Frank the Pug is at the newsstand, and there is the bedraggled, I should say. I mean, I don't know how to say it. There's a guy who works at the newsstand that doesn't look of the world, and Will Smith comments on how it's such a bad disguise, the Pug starts talking.
The first of those two jokes in the movie. Oh, barely a disguise on this guy. Totally looks like an alien. Turns out it's not him, it's the Pug.
Yep. And Tommy Lee Jones violently shakes the Pug and gets him to spill the beans on how everybody is skipping town because the Arcalians are going to blow it up because the galaxy, and the galaxy is, you know, just because it's something that's important, it doesn't mean it's huge. It can be very small. And so that's why it's the best source of subatomic energy. And if the Bugs get it, they can use that against the Arcalians basically wipe them out. So that's why the Arcalians have to prevent it from falling into the hands of the Bugs. And that was our briefing on that. Now, when I had mentioned this movie, Jason said that this is the reason why he likes Pugs, because this is the first time he saw a Pug in the thing.
It's probably the first place I saw a Pug too, but Frank the Pug, I mean, partly because his face is CG, looks different than other Pugs.
Yeah, yeah. CG has that effect on Pugs. But anyway, they go off to Queens, and they got to take the tunnel. And there's a joke here about traffic in New York. And then the red button that he said not to push at the beginning of the film, he says to go ahead and push it. And so they go, and it turns into a rocket thing, and then flies on the top of the tunnel.
Gravity-defying rocket, no less.
Yeah, yeah.
Sticks to the ceiling.
Well, it's all that alien technology and those convertible panel things. And then he puts in an 8-track of Elvis, and Will Smith falls on the roof because he didn't put on a seatbelt. This is all funny because he didn't put on a seatbelt, and he has those weird tiny socks as he's getting back up.
His weird tiny socks.
They are strangely short for dress socks, I must say. And then he talks about how Elvis is dead, and he says, Elvis isn't dead. He went back to his home planet. This is a joke based on several tabloids of Elvis being abducted by aliens and stuff. Whatever. They get out of the tunnel. They arrive at the thing, but too late. The bug guy is dragging her up, and this is where we realize that the postcard that he had grabbed earlier was, of course, of this thing, because they reveal that now. Fortunately, they didn't reveal what the postcard was earlier in the film, because otherwise that would make Will Smith's epiphany about what it was a little less dramatic.
Still wasn't terribly dramatic anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it works. If you're 12 years old, this is an impressive turn. He's dragging her up the ladder thing. She rebels and jumps to the thing. But first she talks about how she's a queen amongst her people and stuff like that. And he's like, oh, well, Your Highness, you know, war is great because it means more food for my family. All 788 million of them or whatever.
Something like that.
Yeah, and so she jumps to a tree, and he's like, yeah, whatever. And then he gets up to the top, takes off in the thing, flies close to whatever baseball team plays in Queens. Help me.
I don't know. Mets, Yankees, one of those two.
Probably the Mets, I'm guessing.
I don't know where either of the stadiums are.
I have no idea.
So ask Gruber.
So the flying saucer's hovering over the thing, and it messes up the ball game. They take their guns that they got out of the back of Kay's trunk, and they blast the ship.
Big guns this time. It's very cool, and he's very excited this time, but he doesn't know what the plan is, and he's like, you know, just shoot it out of the sky. He's like talking about settings, and Will Smith has no idea what's going on. He's like, no, we're out of time. You got to shoot it down quickly.
Yeah, and they shoot it, and it arcs backwards to where it came from,
mm-hmm.
Which is how that works, of course.
Yeah, it's like a Frisbee. You know, if you throw a Frisbee like a little bit of an angle, it like curves up and away, and then it comes flying back at you, and then sliding into the dirt as you stand up against a green screen, and then, yeah. It's very dramatic, right? They're just standing there holding their ground or whatever as the spaceship comes flying up to them. They got their big, you know, machine guns, which, like, you know, if they knew who they were fighting, maybe they would have like backed up a little bit. Cause like, as soon as the bug comes out, he just like grabs both of their guns, like eats them.
Well, when he crash lands, I have to say this shot holds up better than I remember. It holds up as well as I remember. It holds up better than I expected. The model work, for this crash was really top notch. But I will say that the CG composite of the whatever green or blue screen that they did for Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith, the edges are too soft and it's just a blurry mess. And so it kind of ruins the shot because you have all this detailed dirt and stuff flying up behind them, but then they just look like soft cutouts. So it's a little sad.
Yeah, I had that same reaction recently watching Castaway. I don't know if you've seen Castaway recently. There's a green screen there that... works for half of the frame, but not the other half. And it's a very close-up shot of Tom Hanks. But, yeah, anyway.
Yeah. So it crashes, the thing opens up, and Vincent D'Onofrio comes out and yells at him. He's even more bedraggled now than he was when he got into the flying saucer, magically. And they aim their guns at him, but don't just shoot him. And they say to put his hands behind his head, and he's like, oh, like this. And then he pulls off the human skin he had been wearing and unfolds, and they don't take the opportunity to shoot him at this point.
They're just too stunned by this giant, 30-foot cockroach that somehow crammed its way into the Edgar skin.
Yeah, bugs can fit into tiny spaces. And so he unfurls himself, knocks them down and takes their guns and eats them. Kay says he's going to go get his gun back. And then, Will Smith has to do whatever he can to prevent, the bug from leaving the planet. And he jumps inside, not to be seen for a little bit. And Will Smith tries unsuccessfully to beat him and hit him and drag him and
very
whatever.
Odd strategy too, by the way, because the cockroach has very big sharp teeth, but apparently he just made him so angry that he's gonna just eat him whole, I guess. Like, yeah. I mean, what if he just like bit your head off or whatever? Like, that wouldn't have been a good strategy, Kay.
No, there's a lot of risk involved in this plan.
But he kept yelling, eat me, so like presumably like he was actually gonna follow orders. I don't know why.
Yeah. What happened to the noisy cricket? He just didn't have it.
Yeah, I guess he left it in the car once he got his... No, they didn't have names for the giant shotgunny ones. The other one was the Series 4 deatomizer, but I don't think there was a name for the big trunk guns.
Yeah. Well, anyway, he goes after the trunk guns, and nobody has any other guns. And Will Smith's attempts to deter him don't accomplish anything, but he gets kicked into a dumpster, and a cockroach is there, and he gets an idea, because somehow, having not witnessed any of the scenes where the bug was provoked by killing bugs, reasons that killing bugs will provoke him.
It's worth a shot, at least. Yeah, but there, I mean, we, the audience, know that that will make the bug angry, but he definitely doesn't.
Yeah, there's nothing would impart that knowledge to him. So anyway, he starts squishing bugs, and he's like, "Oh, I'm sorry, was that your auntie?" And this angers the bug dude, and he comes down to face Will Smith, because of course he has plenty of time, since there's like 8 minutes till the planet's destroyed.
Yeah, exactly. They just keep cutting back to Zed at the headquarters, just kind of like looking at the clock, like, "Well, this isn't great."
Mm-hmm. And they have they could have done with a less ridiculous countdown, I think. But
you gotta have a ticking clock, man.
But there's ticking clocks, and there's what are you doing? Ticking clocks, and I think this is what are you doing?
I think if you actually measure screen time, it feels like they actually went over their 8 minute time. Even though, like, as soon as they get the galaxy back, he calls Ed and is like, "Yeah, tell him we got it," or whatever, and then we'll meet up or something. I feel like they probably missed their deadline on that one.
Yeah, but they K finds his gun while Jay had been distracting him. You hear the noise, and the cockroach explodes into two halves.
Yeah. Better back up out of my face before something bad happens to you. Too late. Curse splat. He gets shot in half, and then there's goop everywhere, and I had to go get your gun, huh? Well, I really like this gun. We don't really know why, but he liked it. But they got the galaxy. They're covered in goop, and then they're having a chit-chat sitting in the goop. And then the front half of the bug, like, starts crawling up behind him, and he's still alive, and he's going to bite Will Smith's head off is what it looks like. But Morgue Lady blasted into another big pile of goop, and more goop lands on him, and Will Smith, you know, spits out some more goop that got in his mouth or whatever. And she says, "Interesting job you guys got here."
Yep.
And Turns out she was the partner he needed all along.
They all three of them get back into the car, drive back to headquarters, and when they get out of the car, Linda Fiorentino is the only one who's still covered in goo.
Just kind of leaning against the car too, just like, "Hey, but guys, my apartment is near here."
Because she doesn't know anything anymore because her brain has been fried.
Did they already neuralize her? I guess we could assume.
Oh, no, we don't know if they neuralized her for this, but I just mean, like, in general, her brain is probably fried.
Well, when he gets out of the car, he goes, Kay pulls out the neuralizer. He's like, "Hey, you don't have to do that. We can trust her, right? Like, don't neuralize her." And he does the, "No, it's not for her." But, like, we clearly missed the whole galaxy handoff with the Archilians. Well, like, did he put it in like a vacuum tube and just send it to him or something? Or did it actually happen?
It didn't actually happen in screen time, and we know that the fact that she's still covered in stuff, like, when did it occur? They didn't talk about dropping it off with anybody. So presumably they were taking it back to headquarters. So why would he have his mind wiped right before he turns this in? Like, wouldn't he just... Doesn't he have paperwork or something to fill out after this?
Maybe that was the plan all along. He's going to stick Will Smith with the paperwork.
Yeah, well, anyway, so they're in their clean suits. Linda Fiorentino is covered in goop, leaning against a car.
Dripping with goo?
Yes.
Is he up on the best side? There's a lot of goo in New York, basically.
Yeah, well, I mean, New York's disgusting.
Well, if you keep splattering giant cockroaches all over the place and not cleaning it up, of course it's going to be gross. It's just going
to
attract
more
bugs.
Else are you supposed to do?
I don't know, like, hose it down or something. Get the fire crew or whatever to use the flamethrowers.
If you just let the cockroaches run wild, then they'll be everywhere, you know? You got a real Joe's apartment situation.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one.
Welcome to Joe's apartment. It's our apartment, too. We've been here 100 million years, and we'll be here long after you.
Right. I feel like you've said that before, and I didn't understand it.
It's because it's the song. Anyway, watch an important Jerry O'Connell movie once in a while, won't you?
It's Jerry O'Connell's in that movie?
Oh, yeah. So, anyway.
Is it skinny Jerry O'Connell or chubby Jerry O'Connell?
I mean, I don't appreciate that characterization.
When he was little, he was the chubby kid. And what was that movie?
Stand By Me?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was Sliders, Jerry O'Connell.
What's Sliders?
Oh, man. You're killing me, Dan.
I like Sliders, so, like little mini hamburgers.
Yes. Yes, exactly like that. It was Harold and Kumar Go to Sliders.
There's a brewery here that has some good meatloaf sliders.
I disagree with that characterization.
You don't like meatloaf sliders? Wait, do you not like meatloaf?
I mean, I like some meatloaf. I don't like all meatloaf. It depends.
Do you like weird meatloaf, or do you like homey, sort of like down-home canonical meatloaf?
No, I want meatloaf that either I have made or my mom has made or Jason has made.
See, well, you know what? I bet it's the meatball problem again, isn't it? You're very particular about your meatballs as well, and this meatloaf is sort of just like a larger meatball with some sauce on it.
This is exactly the situation we find ourselves in. Because when you get it from some other place, it's like it's just mystery meat. It's just this blob. And also the consistency can be very strange.
It's a loaf of meat that usually has ketchup on top and then baked.
No, but it's not just meat.
There are other things in the meat, yes, but it is essentially...
Yeah. You gotta bind it together. It's how long you bake it. It's the ratio of fat to meat and stuff that you use, the seasonings that you use with it. Some people put mustard on the outside of their meatloaf, and some people put ketchup on the outside of their meatloaf. There's like all kinds of weird things that people do.
Ketchup is, I think, the traditional meatloaf topping, and then, you know, once baked, it gets sort of like a caramely, ketchupy crust.
It grosses me out.
What do you not put a thing on? Do you not put a sauce or a thing on your meatloaf?
No. I if I'm having meatloaf, I want it either plain or there is this Aloha seasoning, and I'm not being horrible to the people of Hawaii. It's called that from the company that makes it. But it's delicious. It sort of turns into like a teriyaki meatloaf.
You're telling me you would rather run dry meatloaf than ketchup meatloaf.
If you make your meatloaf correctly, it shouldn't be dry.
No, well, dry as in it's a meat patty that doesn't have a sauce on it. You gotta have a sauce.
Well, yeah, but it doesn't have to be on the outside of the meatloaf because then it's not a sauce anymore. It's a shell.
It's a topping or whatever. But like,
it's like having tomato fruit leather.
It's like having a burger without putting ketchup and or mustard and or whatever In-N-Out burger sauce on it or something. It's just a straight up meat patty. Like even if it's properly cooked meat patty, you can't just have a straight meat patty.
No, but you can do all that stuff after. It doesn't have to be on the outside of the thing cooking and turning into fruit leather. It can be a sauce still.
Anyway,
the end of this film. There's the flash of the neuralizer to White. Tommy Lee Jones is reunited with the lady we see in the tabloid thing. We reveal that
30-year coma or whatever the hell it was.
Yeah, and we reveal that Will Smith has horrible taste in clothes.
It was the late 90s. You know, I feel like those glasses were the kind of sunglasses that you could buy like Walgreens, but they looked very like weird and like tiny. Kind of, they almost had like an early 90s. The white rapper guy who had like the John Lennon but sunglasses version thing going on.
It just looked like a Maui Jim thing. But
they're also like welding goggles where they've kind of got like that piece of metal that goes back towards your face to presumably block out the light on the sides because your lenses are so small they don't cover your face.
What was more offensive was the shirt and suit.
Right, he's got a collarless button up white shirt and he's got a.
He looks like a reverend from the future.
He's got like a jacket with no lapel that's kind of like folded in, kind of, so it's just like flat against his chest. It's very horrible.
Yes, it's ill-advised. And like you had pointed out, Lena Fiorentino as Agent L now is dressed like a limo driver or someone who waits tables at weddings.
Yeah, and she relays the message of somebody's looking for floor seats for like the Knicks or something, and he says, you know, call Dennis Rodman, he's from that planet, and that's when we get the second version of the Rodman. There's barely a disguise on that guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then they drive away. Yep. And then the song plays again.
And then we pull out from their car to an aerial shot that keeps pulling out and reveals planet Earth, mm-hmm. and then the solar system, and then a big gas cloud, and then a bunch of particles, and then we're inside of a marble, and then there's some aliens who are playing with the marbles, and that's the end of the movie. We're a galaxy inside of a thing, just like the galaxy was inside of a thing inside of the other thing.
It's a marble inside of a marble inside of a marble, but...
Yeah, it's marbles all the way down.
Spoiler for the second movie, not only are we a marble inside of a marble with marbles in our marble, we are also a locker in a bus station with lockers in a bus station.
Yes.
So stupid.
Well, I feel like that's mainly the fault of the second movie.
They're mixing their metaphors here. Are we a marble or are we a bus locker?
Are we heroes or are we dancers?
Hmm.
Hmm. But yeah, no, I like this movie. I don't like the second movie. And so I try not to think about it.
Second movie's not good.
Yeah, no, but this is good. In spite of some of the negative things that we had said, I like this overall, and I think it holds up really well.
Yeah, it
and
works.
In contrast to Wild Wild West, it is not as craven. There is some skill and craft being employed here in trying to make a world that seems consistent with itself for the most part.
There's a lot fewer characters in this movie trying to justify slavery in the Civil War too.
Yes, that also really helps.
That's the benefit of this movie in comparison to Wild Wild West.
Jesus. And the it's also a nice, tightly contained package in which we can feel the evolution of these characters from the start to the end.
It's a fun world that they built that we can enjoy and want to see more of, obviously, because they made a couple more movies.
Yeah, but then you regret that decision.
I mean, you didn't see the third one yet, did you?
No.
Third one's pretty good. I mean, they do some serious retconning, but like in an emotional way. So I'm mm-hmm. not sure if I like hate it or if I'm okay with it, but it's a much better movie.
The one thing that I have to say that bothers me is that about the sequels is that they got rid of Linda Fiorentino, and I don't know why they chose to do that. I never read anything about that decision, but...
I feel like there's a line in the second movie that explains why she
got killed off screen.
No, I think they retired. She retired or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's a line about why he works alone now that what's her name's gone or something. I couldn't tell you what it is though.
I don't remember. But I mean, I liked her in this. You know, she's not. I'll just say it. She's not like an amazing actress. Who like. Will blow your mind, but she's fun in this, mm-hmm. and I think that she worked well with Will Smith. I wonder if they just chose not to move forward with her because she didn't have the star power to keep going.
She didn't have the range to compete with Will Smith.
No, that's not what I was saying. But you know, I also like her in Dogma. Mm-hmm. But I'm hard pressed to think of her in anything else at the moment.
I was gonna click on her thing. Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head either. Oh, well, she hasn't mm-hmm. done a lot since then.
Not a whole lot, no. But I mean, she was good in here.
Yeah.
And you know, she plays a very decent leading character who is a woman in a 90s film, which is not something that you see a lot of, so that,
yeah,
that's
she even
good.
Gives Will Smith crap for like taking the comments sexually. He's like, oh sure, any time a woman shows the slightest bit of interest, you're gonna take it into some sort of weird kinky way. He's like, hey, you know, whatever, you were coming on to me. He's like, no, that's not how it was. Anyway, you should see the third one too though, because it's got Josh Brolin in it playing young Tommy Lee Jones.
And just to round this all out, we had said a lot of negative things about Barry Sonnenfeld last week, and I want to say something
mostly
positive.
Couched in the fact that the movie he made was not good.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and that his career just sort of declined.
I mean, at least he's got a better directing career than I do.
Yeah, well, I mean, he has a better directing career than any of us do, really. But he this is really the jewel in his crown, the galaxy in his
belt,
marble bag,
the galaxy in his belt.
Yeah, this is the best thing that he did. And also his instincts as a director paid off in a couple of instances for sure in the production of this, because it was supposed to mainly take place in like Kansas and stuff. The people producing it basically had optioned this based on comics that had existed before this. They'd stripped out all the other paranormal stuff and it just focused on the aliens. And they weren't sure what director to go with. They thought they wanted him because of Adam's Family and stuff like that. But he wasn't available because he was doing Get Shorty. And so they were going to get this other guy who did Miracle on 34th Street. And then they saw Miracle on 34th Street, said, no, wrong fit. and they waited. They chose to put it off until Barry Sonnenfeld was available, which was a good decision. Barry Sonnenfeld came on board, moved it from Kansas and all that to New York. Felt that New York was a place where you could have a bunch of weird people and the other normal people would accept those weird people as just part of living. So it helped with the movie to seem like more integrated.
I guess it is a bit peculiar that the main bad guy is a weird little farmer guy in downtown New York. Like, it didn't seem like he had to drive particularly far to get to downtown New York.
I mean, he's in upstate New York somewhere.
Upstate New York and all of those, you know, backwoods farms.
I mean, we didn't focus on driving with him, like, on the New York interstate highway system.
I'm just saying, but probably a substantial trip for him.
I mean, it might have been, like, 3 hours. Who knows?
New York's a pretty big state.
Well, no, New York is a big state, but we didn't nail down exactly where he was, so it's fine. He can be exactly as far away from New York as he needed to be. The important part was that New York has the variety in which they could have a farm upstate and also have the city of New York. Mm-hmm. Because if you've ever been to New York, it falls off from being New York City to basically nothing pretty quick. Like, I took the train from New Jersey to New York once, and you're like driving through, what is it, Secaucus or something like that? And you're just like, what in the world is this? It's just like fields of nothing. And then all of a sudden there's just a city in the background. It's so strange. So it all fits together with your expectations. And I think that his instincts were correct in that decision. His instincts were correct in, going with Danny Elfman again, and doing all that. So, it worked really well for this picture. He doesn't always make good decisions, so I feel like I need to say something nice now that he did a good job.
I agree with you.
And with that, we will wrap this up, because we've talked longer than the film.
Here come the men in black.
Men in black. Mr. M.I.B.'s. Here come the M.I.B.'s.
Dress in black, remember that, just in case we ever face to face and make contact. The title held by me, M.I.B., means what you think you saw, you did not see. So don't blink, be what was dead is now gone. Black suit with the black Ray-Bans on. Walk in shadow, move in silence. Guard against extraterrestrial violence. But yo, we ain't on no government list. We straight don't exist, no names and no fingerprints. Saw something strange, watch your back, cause you never quite know where the M.I.B.'s is at.